To your session facilitator, Jim Rice from ICF. Jim?
Thanks, Jean, and thank you all for joining us today. As Jean mentioned, I'm Jim Rice, and I'll be your session moderator. Looks like we have a pretty good crowd. I think we had over 150 that registered, and a good number signed on today from all across the country. We also have a really great group of speakers today, who I'll introduce in just a minute. But first, I'd like to say a few words about this ORD webinar series. So EPA's Office of Research and Development designed this series of webinars to explore some of the challenges that we face when dealing with these mining sites and mineral processing facilities. For those who aren't familiar, ORD is EPA's scientific research arm, and they help inform agency decisions through their research. So the objective of the seminars is to both inform you, the practitioners and stakeholders in this type of work, about the latest tools and methodologies available, but also to understand your needs for research and further development. The webinars are designed to be just like a technical conference, so we'd like your input. In light of getting that feedback, the speakers and webinar team developed a series of interactivities to get your input throughout these presentations. So to get you warmed up, what we'd like to do is we'd like to give you a preliminary question here. So you'll see a question on the screen, and what we'd like you to do is type in a response at the bottom of the page in this box at the very bottom. I'll give you a minute to do that. You'll be able to see how other folks respond. If you see an answer that you like or that you agree with, you can click that plus one button to agree with someone else's response. You can see that all of the comments are ranked by popularity. I'll give you just a minute to click something in. All right, so it looks like we're developing an understanding. You can see from the survey responses that there's quite a few challenges that we face with these mining sites. There we go. Now we're getting a lot of folks respond. So some of these include the type and distribution of the sources, the immense size of our mining sites, interactions between surface and groundwater, and some of the unstable conditions that we face at these sites, along with these potentially very large cleanup costs. So to address all these challenges, we have to find more effective ways to address mine sites throughout the project lifecycle. That is, starting from site characterization all the way through long-term monitoring and closure. So some of these might include innovative characterization and data management tools, planning for these unique emergency responses at mine sites, and applying adaptive management structures to achieve effective remediation. So over the next several weeks, this series of talks is going to bring together some experts to explore the latest thinking in all of these areas. Your job is to listen, digest, and respond to this information and give your feedback. So today's session, the focus will be on emergency response at mine sites. Our first presentation is from Lily Tavassoli, who's an RPM out in EPA's Region 9 office. Lily manages the Iron Mountain Mine Superfund site, and she'll tell us about how her team addressed some extreme weather events like fires and floods that impacted the site. Next, we'll take a look at some emergency response and planning work done at a phosphate processing facility in Mississippi. Tom Cady from EPA's Environmental Response Team in Edison, New Jersey, will discuss some of the challenges working with large mineral processing waste ponds. Tom's a chemical engineer with ERT and works on response actions at Superfund sites throughout the country. Next, Christoph Goss will talk about mine bulkheads and how they're used in response actions to manage mine-influenced water in mine shafts and in tunnels. Dr. Goss is a principal and engineer with Deere and Ault Consultants, and his work focuses primarily on tunneling, underground mine design, and underground rehabilitation. Terry Burton's our final speaker this afternoon, and he'll talk about some of the challenges and solutions for managing legacy uranium mines on tribal lands. Terry's with EPA's ORD, and he's the Superfund technical liaison for EPA Region 6 and is working on a number of legacy uranium sites in the region. So we encourage you to actively participate in these discussions by asking questions, responding to the various poll questions throughout the session. So if we're ready to get started, I'd like to turn the presentation over to our first speaker, Lily Tavasoli. Lily?
Thank you, and good morning and good afternoon to everybody on the phone. I'm happy to be here talking to you all today about the Iron Mountain Mine Superfund site located in Northern California. I'm going to spend the first portion of today's talk just setting up the background history and remediation status of Iron Mountain Mine. Next, I'll talk about the various emergency responses that we've encountered at the site, but most specifically the 2018 car fire, which burned through the site. Next, I'll talk about the lessons learned from an emergency response and planning perspective. So just to provide some context for where Iron Mountain Mine is, it is located in Northern California in one of the most critical watersheds in the state, a complex water management system that consists of multiple dams, but most importantly, the Shasta Dam, which provides over 20% of the state's drinking water supply. This feeds into the Sacramento River, which runs to the San Francisco Bay, and Shasta Dam and the Sacramento River are used for many agricultural, municipal uses, and again, is a critical watershed for the state of California. The history of the site, so Iron Mountain Mine is a 4,400-acre property that sits just below the Shasta Dam, a couple miles off from the top of the Sacramento River, so really critical site location. And it was mined for a period of nearly 100 years for various metals. Its impacts led to historic discharges into the Sacramento River of 6 tons of metals per day. Nearly 5 tons of that was iron and 1 ton of primarily copper, cadmium, and zinc. So to give you an idea of the scale of the impact, this was really a very detrimental issue for the Sacramento River, the health of that river, and especially the aquatic populations, including threatened and endangered species of fish. So the site was listed in 1983, and in 2 minutes, I'm going to summarize 30 years of Superfund response work. But one of the unique things about Iron Mountain that I always like to mention is that we are very special and fortunate to have the world's worst recorded water. We have negative pH inside at least one of our mines, the Richmond Mine. And so you can imagine if you put that kind of on a scale of 6 tons of heavy metals per day, we have a really, really bad acid mine drainage problem, really, really low pHs that are not diluted with winter flows at all. So a really high magnitude and scale of impact regionally from this single mine site. But again, to just summarize the remediation that's taken place over the last 30 years, EPA has invested significantly in the site and spent a lot of money implementing over 5 interim remedies. We've successfully enforced at this site, and we have a remedy that's valued at approximately $1 billion. In 2000, we reached a settlement that provided for 30 years of treatment and also provided for a second portion of that consent decree, which would provide funds for treatment for the next phase of the project. So we have a wonderful, as a result of that enforcement, we have a wonderful site operator who does a very good job staffing the site 24 hours a day, 365 days a year to implement a remedy that costs approximately $5 million a year to implement. And how effective is that remedy? Very. In the course of the 5 interim remedies that have been implemented at the site, this has led to a 97% reduction of metals leaving the Iron Mountain Mine Superfund site. And just to give you a very brief overview of what that system consists of, We essentially capture, collect, and convey for treatment acid mine drainage from four primary sources at the site. Specifically, we have two underground mines that we capture and collect acid mine drainage from, the Richmond and Lawson mines. And then we have two other sources. One is, you can see in this photo here, the Slick Rock Retention Reservoir, which captures, you can see this hillside here. There's a lot of seepage, buried portals. Any acid mine drainage coming off this mountainside is collected here. And we also have a source here where we pump out a submerged adit, and that all goes into, from all of our four sources, they all lead into high-density HDPE lines, big 24-inch lines that convey this acid mine drainage down the mountain several miles to our treatment plant. So again, capturing and collecting four sources of acid mine drainage ranging from a little less than 1 pH to a little less than pH 3, conveying that here to our Minnesota Flats treatment plant, our high-density sludge treatment plant, where we precipitate out those heavy metals, feed them to our sludge drying ponds, where we let those bake out in the Redding sun, the 115-degree summer heat that we have there over the course of the summer, and then we haul that up to Brick Flat Pit, which is a former open pit mine that has been repurposed into our sludge disposal landfill. So that is a very brief summary of how the remedy at Iron Mountain Mine works. And again, the point here is really to provide some perspective on just the scale and impact of the site. And if you can imagine that over 250 million gallons of water a year that we treat was released during an emergency response event that we were unable to capture successfully those acid mine drainage flows, that would be hugely detrimental to the Sacramento River. So next I'm going to move on to talk about the extreme weather events that have taken place at the site. And there have been a number over the course of the years, but I'm going to focus mostly on the 2018 car fire. We've had a number of floods at the site which have taken out significant site infrastructure, and we've had significant fires. But until 2018, we hadn't seen the level of kind of widespread impact both to the site and then regionally that we saw in the car fire. So many folks nationally are aware the car fire hit Northern California in July of 2018 and wasn't fully out until August 30th of 2018. Ultimately, it was one of the most destructive fires in state history and burned over 230,000 acres. There was a number of fatalities and over 1,500 structures destroyed in this fire. So just to put it in regional context, this was devastating to the area. But for Iron Mountain Mine, this fire came through very quickly for us and had very serious impacts for the site. So I'm going to summarize those impacts really briefly and just say that it was kind of multiple levels of concern. So we have, when that fire hit Iron Mountain Mine and passed through the 4,400-acre property, we were concerned about a couple of things. The first was the protection of the treatment plant. As you saw in one of the previous slides, the Minnesota Flats treatment plant is a really critical piece of the site infrastructure. You can capture and collect acid mine drainage, but if you don't have a treatment system to treat it, you will overwhelm your storage capacity and eventually be putting that AMD directly into the Sacramento River. We were concerned about that, but we had site operators who stayed at the site, who protected the defensible space of the site and prepared the site to be locked down. We stopped acid mine drainage treatment and started switching over to our storage areas, where we were able to have approximately 14 days of AMD storage. We also anticipated losing power to the site, so this is another reason we stopped treatment and just started relying on our AMD storage. We also had the help of firefighter crews who stayed at the site overnight to protect the plant, and you can see in the image on the left just how close it came to the treatment plant. This is a photo from inside the administrative building, which is located in that treatment plant area. We also had a concern about the loss of above ground infrastructure. I mentioned that we convey acid mine drainage to the treatment plant via HDPE lines. The majority of those are buried underground, which turned out to be a huge asset for us because we would have lost the majority of our conveyance infrastructure if that had not been the case. But there are specific areas that for specific reasons those lines do come above ground. The photo on the right is an image of a firefighter fighting one of these areas where some of these flows are directed overland due to being run over a landslide, which can move slightly in significant rainfall years. And so the loss of above ground infrastructure was something that was important for us to get a handle on very quickly. And just the immediate threats that kind of kept coming to mind, you know, we had taken diesel and gasoline deliveries before the fire started in anticipation that we would lose power to the site. Well, one of our spot fires was right next to one of our gasoline tanks. So the risk to folks and the risk to the treatment infrastructure of having that happen was also a big deal. But as the fire passed through the site, we kind of moved past this preliminary active fire period and then had a chance to assess what was going on. In that day or two after the fire passed through the site, we started establishing a baseline of impacts and discovered what turned out to be the biggest issue of all. We had an area where the HDPE line came above ground and entered the Richmond mine portal. To remind you, this is our one of our sources of acid mine drainage that we collect. This HDPE line runs underground and several hundred feet back into the mine workings where it collects acid mine drainage and then conveys it again via undergrounded HDPE lines to our treatment system. We found that this HDPE line was on fire and going back towards the ore body inside the mine. This led to activation of our emergency response team and really the whole incident command structure that comes along with that. So we were really an incident within a much larger car fire incident. We were concerned about this for a number of reasons. We didn't exactly know the level of impact, and there were many reasons that it was unlikely the ore body would actually ignite, but we do know that the impacts of having a pyritic ore body be on fire in an area with approximately 25 miles of collapsed and partially open underground workings would have some severe consequences. So again, we assessed ways to put out this fire, and I'm summarizing a really, really huge response in a couple minutes, but what I'll say is that basically we implemented a multi-pronged approach where we developed several alternatives for how to extinguish this fire as it slowly moved further back into the mine. We took our resources as we received them, and ultimately after sending in two robots, which got stuck, we did personnel entries and extinguished the fire at something like 3:30 in the morning. You can imagine also this is in the middle of an active fire zone. The whole region is devastated, and there's responders coming from all over the country just to deal with a very active fire, which was still growing at its perimeter at the time. So a very chaotic context for us to be working in. This is obviously a much more complicated and longer story, but I'm summarizing it here to just help provide context for some of our lessons learned. So I'm going to move on, and just before I get into lessons learned, I just want to look at the right side of the page, and just the happy news here is that throughout this fire, we did not lose capture and collection of acid mine drainage. The redundancies that we have built into our system, the undergrounding of our AMD lines, the built-in storage that we have capability to use in an emergency meant that we just had to hold flows for approximately 1 week until we could start running off generators and until then power was restored. We had really minimal infrastructure loss relative to the scale and nature of this emergency. We did have, you know, a lot of repairs that had to be done over the course of the fall, but we were ready for the winter, and we had a very, very difficult winter in the months following the car fire, but in general, it could have been much worse, and really the core components of our treatment system and site infrastructure were intact. So, you know, I don't know if success is the right word, but we certainly were prepared, and I'm going to talk about a couple of the things that made us more prepared here. With respect to the emergency response, specifically the response inside the Richmond Mine Portal with the fire, there's a couple specific lessons learned that I wanted to share. First, I just want to say, you know, relationships were our resources. We spent almost a full day of a very, you know, high-pressure situation on the phone nationally with any organization, any private mining company, any federal agency, state, that was willing to talk to us and give us their expertise and ideas. And this was a really important thing for us, and I would suggest anybody going through this type of emergency, spend as much time you can on the phone, talking to other people who might have a lead for you and some information that might be helpful to you. We found that as options came up for us, we said yes to everything. Send us resources, mobilize as soon as you can, bring us more than you need, just use those resources as they arrive for you. And then finally, I'll say a lot of people want to know what's going on, but very few people can help in a mine-specific emergency. And I say that because we had a very unique combination of circumstances. We had an underground mine fire. We needed hazmat expertise, firefighting expertise, underground mining expertise. And the way that I kind of made sure that our group, our stakeholder group, as wide as that was at that time, was informed is before the fire even hit the site, I started sending these daily blast emails that people could forward to anybody who might be interested in the situation at Iron Mountain Mine. So that was a really critical lesson learned for us. In general, the four tools that I think were very important for us in being successful in this fire, things that we did before this fire happened and that we're continuing to do in recovering from the fire, adaptive management, of course. So we have experienced emergencies, and the site has been strengthened, and infrastructure has been planned based on the weaknesses identified in previous emergencies. We had a fire in 2008. We learned it was much smaller scale than the car fire. We learned an incredible amount from that, and we used that to better understand how to build redundancies into our remedy and how to effectively plan with external stakeholders so that when the time came and an emergency hit, we would be prepared. We have a very robust emergency preparedness plan that the site operator has prepared. It's a living document which is updated as needed. It has very specific scenarios that are outlined with emergencies, a mine tunnel collapse, the landslide goes, the treatment plant burns down, you know, you have severe floods which prevent lime deliveries to the site. That has been an issue for us in recent years in large floods, but I'm not going to get into that detail. We have specific scenarios that go through steps of what you do in each of those, and it's really oriented towards specific kind of vendors and steps that you would take to contact vendors to get things delivered. You know, you can't deliver lime to the site one way. You have this alternate road. That road's out. Here's a number for a helicopter. Basically, what do you need to do to keep this system from resulting in an off-site release? We also have done emergency responders meetings. This is something we plan to do more of in the future. After the 2008 fire, we found that one of the things that happens in an emergency response is that everyone's scattered. The structure of the just personnel structure of the fire is such that we have people who aren't local. They don't know Iron Mountain Mine and the site very well. And so having external stakeholders come to the site, learn more about the site, learn what's there in a non-emergency situation, it really helps prepare us for when the emergency hits. In this case, I heard a lot of people say, I don't know what Iron Mountain was, but somebody who's local knew about it, told us it was important, you know, we had a lot of coordination with our Cal Fire agency in making sure that they protected our site and that they worked with other external stakeholders such as PG&E to get our power restored to us very, very quickly. The last thing I want to mention, this is actually, I think, one of the most unique and helpful tools for us in this process, the use of an asset management plan. This is a tool that's not frequently, as far as I understand, used at Superfund sites. It has been tremendously helpful for us, and I will give credit to the site operator for undertaking this large, multi-year, resource-intensive process. It has many benefits for site management, understanding your cost implications over a number of years, what your maintenance obligations might be. But for emergency planning specifically, it gave us a very good framework to be recovering from. So when the emergency hit, we pulled that site asset list, and you know, we have every pump, every road, every car, every component of what makes the site work inventoried, and you could just go through that and start taking notes on, you know, what's been damaged, what needs immediate repair. The assessment of risk that comes with the asset management planning process helps you prioritize what's an important asset to replace quickly versus what is something that can wait until after the next winter, for instance. So that's a very detailed process that was undertaken, but I'll just say that I think not a lot of Superfund sites use this tool, and that it's been a very, very important one for us, and a very good overall site-wide management tool. So to summarize, you know, Iron Mountain has gone through a number of large emergencies, and we certainly know that because of our location and because of the scale of impact from the site, we will go through these again, and they'll be highly critical to respond to successfully. These are a couple of the tools that we've used to ensure that success and that we're going to continue using in the future. And with that, I'll open it up for, I'll be happy to take any questions.
Thanks, Lily. That was fascinating. Boy, you really had some challenges there. One of the questions that we received has to do with getting access to the site during the operations. It sounded like there was fire everywhere and some real challenges. How are you able to gain access to the site and to keep access to the site during these emergency operations?
That's a fantastic question. Access was one of the first issues that we ran into. Folks that have experienced large fires may know that many times the local sheriff's office, in this case the National Guard in conjunction with the sheriffs, immediately closed the roads leaving town. So anywhere that was impacted by the fire was essentially cut off because of danger to folks going into their homes at that point, and then also really large-scale issues with looting. It took a lot of reaching into and integrating into the incident command structure of the car fire to reach the right people through the liaison officer to make sure that we communicated with the highest levels of CHP, California Highway Patrol, and the National Guard and the Shasta County Sheriff's Office to make sure that we had special badges made. Essentially, our folks were the only people other than firefighters and the power company that were let onto the roads to get to the site. This was a huge challenge for us in 2008 because we were actually kicked off the property. We tried to explain that we had important infrastructure there and we needed to continue treating even if there was a fire. And they said, nope, there's a fire, get out of here. So this is an important lesson learned that we wanted to really avoid in this fire. And I hope that answers the question.
Thankfully, I think it does. So it looks like we're at the end of our time for Lily's presentation. Just a reminder to folks, if you do have additional questions that you want to pose to Lily about this fascinating operation, feel free to enter them in the Q&A box, and we'll try to get back to you after the session's done. So I'd like to introduce our next speaker. It's going to be Tom Cady from EPA's ERT, and he'll talk about emergency response and planning work at the phosphate plant in Mississippi. Tom, are you on?
I am. Can you hear me okay, Jim?
Sounds great. Go ahead.
All right, good. Okay, this is the Mississippi Phosphates plant in Pascagoula, Mississippi. It's a mineral processing site. They make diammonium phosphate fertilizer. So it's not a mine per se, but they process a lot of minerals at this facility right along the Gulf of Mexico. So I'll give you a couple of slides to give you an idea of what the facility looks like and where it's situated. So we're right on the Gulf of Mexico in Pascagoula, Mississippi, right along Bayou Cassatt. You can see, let's see, I don't have my green arrow, but let me see, I can just show you this. A Mississippi Phosphate facility right here, this is the footprint of the MPC site. Bayou Cassatt is right adjacent to it, right in this area, and then of course this is the Gulf of Mexico here. Just to the south of Mississippi Phosphates, we have one of the largest refineries in the United States, if not the world. It's a Chevron facility. They produce about 600,000 gallons of gasoline per day. So industrially speaking, this is a very busy port and a very central part of not only Mississippi's economy, but the United States and world economy, actually. So very busy area. Right next door to it, we have the Grand Bay National Estuary Research Reserve and Grand Bay Wildlife Preserve up to the northeast. So this is 27,000 acres of pristine estuary with a number of endangered species and whatnot. So we have a big industrial facility, a region actually, and right next to it, a very environmentally sensitive area, not to mention the Gulf of Mexico itself. So this photograph is oriented with the Gulf of Mexico over to the right. So we're looking at Bayou Cassatt, and here is our Mississippi Phosphates plant outlined in red. The actual plant area is right here. We have a West Gypstack complex. It's in interim closure, so it is no longer operating. We had a number of storage ponds to the north of that Gypstack complex, but the main Gypstack complex of concern with this discussion is what we call the East Gypstack and Pond Complex. So just like taking a picture of the Grand Canyon, nothing ever comes out quite large enough when you take a photo of it, and it's hard to get a sense of scale of this facility. But let me talk a little bit about the process first. So here's how this process works of making diammonium phosphate. First, you'll bring in phosphate rock by ship. It could come in from overseas or places in the United States, generally from overseas. That rock is placed in these large piles up in this area. The next step of the process is to mix that phosphate rocks with sulfuric acid that's manufactured at the plant itself. And the product that you get from that process is phosphoric acid. The waste that you get from that step in the process is what we call the phosphogypsum solution or slurry. So you have phosphate rock that's left over, gypsum that's left over in a acidic solution, and that's what's sent over to the Gypstack complexes. That gypsum precipitates out of that slurry, and it's used to make the Gypstacks itself, and the water is stored within the impoundment created by the Gypstack. Precipitates out. The second part of the process is making the fertilizer itself, and what you'll do is you'll bring in another ship of ammonia, liquid ammonia. You'll mix that with the phosphoric acid, and that's what produces the diammonium phosphate solution. That is then dried and pelletized and loaded onto other ships and sent throughout the United States and the world to fertilize crop production. That's how the facility operates. The wastewater that you get from that plant, it's not a complete reaction, so you end up with a lot of diammonium phosphate solution left over. And that is also stored within the Gypstack impoundments and recirculated back into the process because it can be used as a raw material in continuing to make the diammonium phosphate. So the facility operators view that water, that processed water that's stored in the large impoundments as raw material feed. so it does has value to them. In order to keep these impoundments at the right liquid level, you want to keep them close to full because you don't want them to dry out and desiccate and lose their contents, but you don't want them to overtop either. So there's usually they usually operate within, you know, a 10-foot range of freeboard with these impoundments. And when you start getting rains, you need to treat the water that falls into the pond so that you can maintain that freeboard balance. And there's a fixed facility wastewater treatment plant that processes about 1.2 million gallons a day of the excess wastewater. And it's largely a neutralization process where you add lime, get the pH from 2 up to pH of 11. That precipitates out everything, and then you acidify it and bring that pH back down to about a neutral level and kick that out into Biocasat and out to the Gulf of Mexico. So let's get a sense of scale of this East Gypstack pond complex. This is just a little Google Maps measurement around the complex itself, and you can see that that's about 15 million square feet, or you know, roughly 350 acres. So what does that really mean? I've prepared this presentation for people in headquarters initially, trying to describe some of the emergency situations that we were potentially facing here. And this is the same footprint overlaying on Ronald Reagan National Airport. You see it takes up most of the airport. I think that was the reason I picked Ronald Reagan Airport is that EPA has their facility right here in Potomac Yards, which is that's the building, our office building that we're pointing to. So we just told the folks, take a look out your window and look at that airport and imagine that whole thing being ponds of PH2 water. Another way to look at the sense of scale here is this is a look at the East Gypstack from the bottom, looking at two men that we have up here at the top. This stack is 120 feet tall, and that's what two guys up at the top happen to look like when you're standing at the bottom. When you go up onto the top of the Gypstack pile, you'll see, Gene, can you give me my arrow again, please? That green arrow is disappearing on me. But anyway, we're standing on top of the East Gypstack pond, and you'll see these stacks off in the distance. That's the Chevron facility right along the Gulf of Mexico. So that's an enormous facility. This pond is a 25-acre pond on top of the Gypstack, and the pond behind us here, shown in the second picture, the pond behind us, pickup trucks, is a 15-acre pond. So these are very large ponds up on the top of these Gypstack piles, and when the winds kick up, you can get 3- and 4-foot waves on top of these Gypstack piles. Stakeholder concerns. We were asked to come down to this facility and take a look at the structural integrity of these impoundment complexes. What had happened is Mississippi Phosphates declared bankruptcy and stopped operations. We were called down about 1 year after operations had ceased because a number of the stakeholders in the area, Chevron, the people from the wildlife management preserves, the Chamber of Commerce in the Pascagoula region, all had concerns, you know, what would happen if we had some sort of failure of this pond complex now that the plant is no longer operating. There were plenty of reasons to have that concern. In the past, Mississippi Phosphates had actually discharged 38 million gallons of acidic wastewater when they were not able to manage that freeboard balance that I'd mentioned because of heavy rains and discharged more than 38 million gallons of acidic water into Biocasat. That ended up killing over 47,000 fish and also closed the bayou. So it shut down all business in that area until that spill could be released. When this material, you know, goes into the water and instantly neutralizes by mixing with the water in the bayou and the Gulf of Mexico, it precipitates out into this white slurry that looks like milk of magnesia. So it's an eyesore, number one. It's a very public nuisance, and it kills a lot of fish because of the ammonia and the phosphorus that's in the water itself. So the first thing we did after listening to the stakeholders was go out and do a facility tour, and this was the condition of the top of the gypsum stack. When the plant is operating, you're getting fresh gypsum, you know, being delivered into the pond continuously each day. And what you'll do is where this gentleman is standing, you'll have a long reach track hoe up at the top, and that reaches out to this second berm that you see out in the water. And what they're doing is they're scooping fresh liquid, or not liquid, but saturated gypsum out from the bottom of this little area that they've got between the two berms and pulling it up onto the bank. So you're continually watering down and building up the impoundment banks with fresh gypsum. When the process stops, which it had stopped for a year at this point in time, you'll see that this gypsum desiccates, it dries out, it cracks. We have piping throughout the entire perimeter of the chip stack pile. And what the piping is, when the waves hit against the side, you drill, basically the water drills these little holes into the banks, the exposed banks of the gypsum. And we saw that at that point in time, they were probably 2-3 feet into the chip stack itself. And we saw cracks that would go completely across the berm crest, which is supposed to be 20 feet. And at this point in time, we had areas that were as little as 12 feet in width. So a serious concern here about breaching these impoundments. So this is a look down the side of the gypsum stack pile, and you can see the inner berm and the outer berm. And you can see this should be a nice, you know, nicely sloped, nicely maintained crest of the impoundment, and you can see the kind of erosion that was being experienced up there from, you know, not operating this facility at all for over the course of a year. Looking down the outside of the berm, you could see seeps in the sidewalls. We could see saturated material, you know, coming out of the sidewalls itself. So, and this was supposed to be a nicely benched, nicely sloped outside of an impoundment, much like you'd see a landfill constructed, and is pretty much just eroding away. We have a 6-to-1 slope here, so it's not a very, very steep slope, but you know, at our benches we have a 3-to-1 slope, but the overall slope is a 6-to-1 slope, but it was seriously deteriorating at the time of our initial inspection. So, you know, take a look at these benches. I want to show you that. These were deteriorated, but they get worse over time, and we'll talk about that a little later in the presentation. So our facility tour findings, this is back in 2015, was that this pond, Pond 3 and Pond 4 up on top of these gypsum stacks, had seriously compromised impoundment berms, and the crests were only 12 feet in width in many places where they should be 20 feet. There was inadequate freeboard, so we had a lot of concerns that we may overtop these impoundments. We had this treatment plant that I mentioned to you in a previous slide that could treat 1.2 million gallons a day, but the problem is this. 1.1 million gallons a day times 365 days is about 400 million gallons a year. That assumes that there's no downtime with this plant, and there was always downtime with this particular plant because it was not in good condition. As you might imagine, when a facility goes bankrupt, there were a lot of things that were not optimal about this particular facility. The big culprit here is 1 inch of rainfall adds 9 million gallons of contact water to the ponds. We usually get 64 inches of rainfall a year in Pascagoula. And so say 20 inches of that evaporates, that still leaves you with a net add of almost 400 million gallons of rainwater that falls into these ponds on a yearly basis that has to be treated. So we call this the cost of rain. Doing nothing at this facility, not reducing your footprint, not getting rid of the water that you have within these impoundments, cost you $5 million a year just to maintain the status quo. So when the facility went into bankruptcy, they set up an environmental trust for $10 million. So that's what the trust had to operate the facility as a result of the bankruptcy. Well, $5 million of the $10 million went to water treatment. This is in the first year. This is before EPA took it over. So it's being run by a bankruptcy trust overseen by the governments And by governments, I mean the federal government, EPA, and the state of Mississippi. But the trust was actually doing the operation of the facility. So 5 million gallons went just to water treatment alone. Another 2 million, not gallons, $6 million, I'm sorry. Another 2 million of the $10 million went to impoundment maintenance, trying to fix and repair these the sloughing and cracking and desiccation that I showed you in those photos. And the trust chose, you know, at the advice of the governments, to spend another $3 million of that trust money in infrastructure improvements. And what that was HDPE piping, miles of it, to connect these various ponds so that you could move water from one pond to drain it to the extent where you could repair the impoundment itself and then fill it back up. So it was miles of HDPE pipe, significant pumping capacity, and improving the discharge capacity in the outfall in Bayou Cassatt. We were limited to about, I believe it was a 1 to 2 million gallon per day discharge in the bayou, and we improved the pumping and the discharge array in the bayou so that we could kick out up to 4 million gallons a day in the event of an emergency, so we had some flexibility in operating the facility. In hindsight, that was money very well spent. As Lily mentioned in her presentation, having these infrastructure improvements that give you the flexibility to handle an emergency situation proved to be a very fortunate thing. So our recommendations from the first walk was to repair and maintain these berms, reduce the water levels so that we had adequate freeboards so that you could handle a 9-inch rain, increase the water treatment capacity so that you had the ability to get more than 1 million gallons a day out of the facility. Again, 1 foot of water in that 25-acre pond that I showed you was 7.5 million gallons. So you could pump for a week to lower that one foot, and then you could get a 1-inch rainstorm, and all that water you treated over the course of that week is back into your pond complex again. So you needed the ability to pump out 2 or 3 times that amount a day if you wanted to significantly reduce capacity in any of those ponds to do repair before you had to move water back into that pond after the repair. So you really needed this flexibility to discharge a lot or to pump a lot from one pond to another if you were to handle any kind of unforeseen or even foreseen weather event. We maintain very high level management visibility and support. We ran this both up the regional chain of command, the state chain of command, headquarters chain of command. The regional administrator had conference calls weekly, if not daily, on this facility and its status on a daily basis, as did the administrator of EPA. It was a very, very high visibility project. And why? In the summer of 2017, we got a call from Israel about a phosphogypsum stack that they had from another diammonium phosphate fertilizer plant near the Dead Sea. And this thing had partially collapsed, and you can see the collapse in the sidewall of that particular chip stack pile. Looks very similar to the Mississippi phosphates, a little steeper walls to it. But we just had a partial collapse, and you saw in some of our photos where we had cracks going completely across the crest of the berm. And if you get enough water flowing through those cracks and you saturate enough of the outer walls or the entire wall, thickness of the wall, this is the kind of collapse that you can have. This released 26 million gallons instantaneously. Again, very low pH water, and it left a 12-mile wake of destruction throughout the desert leading to the Dead Sea. So they called us to ask us, you know, what are the warning signs for this sort of thing? And I'll tell you one of the warning signs. So we went back to this facility, which now EPA had been operating for about a year's time. And I told you that you normally get 64 inches of rain in Pascagoula in a year. Once EPA took it over, I guess it's luck of the draw, we had over 100 inches the first year and 120 inches the second year. So it was just a massive amount of rainfall, and had those infrastructure improvements not been maintained, there is no way we could have contained the water or treated enough to discharge it. But anyway, after a year, this is what the outer wall looked like at this facility. And you can see we had seeps running straight through the sidewall. They had now reached the outside of the wall, so this wall had been saturated and completely breached, and about 100 gallon per minute seeps, you know, all along the outside. So there were probably, you know, six or seven of these types of seeps around the perimeter of this gyp stack pile. The benches that I'd shown you in a previous photo had completely collapsed, and they collapsed because they're saturated. They've been eroded and they're saturated. But this is, at least to our eyes, the experts that we had down at the facility, this is what that gyp stack in Israel looked like just before it's ready to fail. This is a photograph of active failure of a gyp stack. It is in the process of failing, just like the one in Israel. So this became an all hands on deck situation, and basically what the folks did, EPA was running this at this point in time, said, look, we've got to empty these ponds and take them out of service. The only way that we could do that was to do emergency bypasses. So we did pH neutralization only with sodium hydroxide and released about 400 million gallons to Biokasat over five different events over the course of that summer to get ponds 3 and 4, the two ponds I showed you at the top of the gyp stack, emptied. Treatment costs were about a little over, you know, a penny a gallon, almost 2 pennies a gallon, but you're talking about an awful lot of gallons. So it spent about $12 million just doing treatment of that material. And we tried to discharge it and monitor in a way that, you know, we didn't have these algal blooms or eutrophication of the bayou or the Gulf of Mexico. We had no adverse impacts, so it was done carefully, but it was done carefully or quickly in order to avert a catastrophic release of this material. After that point, we got serious about reducing the footprint of this facility because, you know, another large year, a year of large rainfall, and we're back to square one again. Now we don't have these two ponds as containment capacity anymore. So you've got to reduce the footprint so rainfall doesn't increase water you have to treat. So we went into a closure design for the facility, and over the course of the past year, you see a before and after photo. This is the gyp stack pile when the ponds were full a couple years ago. It's about half fixed on the outside now, so it's graded, it's properly benched now, and the ponds are empty, as you can see. There's a large pond in the background. That'll be closed next. Here's a view from the north looking south. Again, this is what it looks like when it was in bad condition. This is pond 4. Pond 3 is back there, and this is what it looks like today. We've put about 10 acres of liner down so far and have yet to, you know, finish grading the east side of the gyp stack at this point. So Region 4 is handling this at this point. The plan is to close the entire facility. It'll be about a $120 million project. And plan to do it over the next couple years. Craig Zeller is the EPA RPM on this facility, and that he's managing the closure of the facility right now, and here's his contact information if anybody has questions, and my contact information is below that. Any questions that I could answer?
Well, Tom, we don't have any questions from the participants right now, but as a reminder, please feel free to enter some questions or comments that you have, especially if you're working on other phosphate facilities in the Gulf Coast area or in Florida. We'd love to hear from you and understand what some of your concerns are that might be supported by EPA's ORD research program. So if there's no further questions, to stay on track, I'd like to move to our next speaker, who will be Christoph Goss, who will talk about mine bulkheads. Christoph, are you on the line?
All righty. I'm on the line. Hello, everybody. So I was asked to talk a little bit about mine bulkheads and, you know, the topic today, emergency management. I thought, well, what are some key concepts about bulkheads that an EPA responder, be short-term or kind of medium-term, would kind of need to know or kind of care about? So what EPA responders should know about EPA, about mine bulkheads, or my mindset has a bulkhead. What do I do with it? All right. Well, let's figure out what we can. All right. A quick outline here. Just give a little overview of, you know, why is that mine there? What's kind of the cycle for a hard rock mine? Talk about what a bulkhead actually is and what it isn't. Risks, real and imagined, for bulkheads. How you integrate a bulkhead into your site plan. And then bulkhead, you know, post-bulkhead installation, you know, the care and feeding of your new favorite bulkhead. Start with a little bit of geology. We'll start with a volcano right in here because everybody loves volcanoes, right? So, you know, the reasons why is the mine in a certain spot is because the metal is there. Why is the metal there? Well, that's because of the geology. Here's kind of our cartoony view of this. You've got some sort of magma plume that comes up in the earth, and it heats the rock, and you've got all kinds of metal-rich liquids and gases that come up. Now, as it moves in, it cracks all the rock above, forms all these faults and joints, and these faults and joints now get filled with all these liquids with metals in them, and as they depressurize, they cool down, these liquids go out of solution, and they attach themselves to the sides of these cracks and joints there. And if you've got enough metal that attaches itself to the walls of those joints, you have what's called a vein, and if you have enough veins in the area, that means it's worth mining. So, when it's worth mining, let's talk about a couple terms that you have for going underground. That black blob there in the middle, that's one of those veins you saw in the other picture in there. You know, that's the ore. That's the material you're trying to get out. And ore is simply, you know, rock that has enough metal in it that it's worth mining. Couple other terms, we don't go through all the terms on here, but what's kind of important is an adit. I'll refer to that quite a bit. An adit is simply a tunnel that does not go all the way through the mountain. That's about it. And a shaft is kind of a vertical access into your mine workings. And bulkheads are going to be installed, you know, in an adit, somewhere underground. So here's a little cross-section of some mountainous area, kind of pre-mining. So well, what you have, you've got your lovely brown mountains there. You've got some faults in the area, and these faults, you know, are actually veins because they actually have enough good metal in them. Now, what you also have, you see the groundwater is, it's kind of similar to the mountains up above, but they're in the different compartments. Kind of the faults act as dams between their compartments, and so you've got these different groundwater compartments there. And so you get here to the mining, and I've just lost the drills in my mind. I hit the space bar again on that. Sorry, guys. Okay, there we are. Thank you so much, Gene. Appreciate that. Okay, so back to the let's go to the actual mining part here. So we've established that there's all kinds of good stuff over in these faults and veins, and so you start mining. And so what they do, they start digging down and digging in and digging down and digging in, and boy, just everything's going really, really well. But then you get deep, and you start hitting the groundwater. All of a sudden, life's not so good anymore because your mine is wet. And that means you have to pump it out. And if you have to pump out the water, it gets really expensive. And so it may not be worth mining anymore. So what happens is a bunch of the mines in the area, they get together, and they drive a drainage tunnel down below all their mines that, well, very effectively drains the water out of the mountain. And you can see the groundwater level has gone down real nicely there. Now you've got nice dry mines that you can happily work on. In addition, they'll drive a shaft all the way down to that drainage tunnel, and that drainage tunnel will act as your haulage way to get all of your ore out as well. So, you know, life is good, right? Oh, well, there's a little thing there. You see the beautiful yellowish-orange acid mine drainage that's now kind of starting to make its way down. And because what happens is, you know, life's pretty good while they're doing all this mining, but at some point the mines run out, and it's the end of mining. Now, back in the day, this means the mines are abandoned, everybody happily leaves, and hey, you know, it keeps on draining, and who really cares? Well, of course, that ends up being a bit of a problem, right? So the drainage tunnel continues to do what it always has and drains the whole mountain. Now, you've got all this exposed ore, you've got all these exposed mine workings there, and, you know, they start to form acid mine drainage, because what happens is that the oxygen reacts with the pyrite in these rocks, it forms sulfuric acid, which then dissolves the metals, and so you've got, very acidic metal-laden water that flows out. So this forms metal precipitate and bacterial ooze and other nasty materials all in it. Now, that's bad enough to have all that kind of stuff coming out of the mountain. But here's what else happens. You know, you've got some tunnel underground that's, you know, no longer being supported. And at some point, there'll be a roof fall, material falls in and creates a little dam underground. And then the water builds up behind it. And at some point, boom, it blows out. And you get a big old surge of nasty material coming out through a portal. So, bad problem. And who knows how well it's going to come out, because probably a portal's collapsed, and you're just going to have unchecked water flowing out through debris. Again, not a real controlled situation. Here's what it typically looks like behind a closed or a collapsed portal. That's a lot of orange scunge back there, and boy, if that makes into the rivers, you've got some headline news. So, time for some post-mining evaluation. First question is a drainage a problem for water quality? If you're on this call, it probably is. If the drainage is a water quality problem, then you've got two general solutions. You can build a treatment plant, like you see in this picture, and you can maintain the drainage tunnel and keep the mine draining, and you treat the water in perpetuity. And in some cases, that's simply the only real feasible option. Another option, in some cases, is to install bulkheads, and these are essentially underground dams. So what happens when you put bulkheads into this drainage tunnel? Well, you see the two green bulkheads right in there. They've now stopped up the water. Now, the groundwater level has gone up. See our blue arrow going up there, so groundwater level is going back up. Now, what happens to acid mine drainage? Well, the parts of the mines that are flooded, you get no or, let's say, probably less AMD that forms there because there's no more oxygen to react with the pyrite. You do still have, in the parts of the mine that are still not flooded, you still do get some acid mine drainage coming out. Alrighty, so bulkheads are not those green blobs that you saw out there. What do bulkheads more look like? Well, bulkheads are engineered concrete plugs, and they're designed to hold back water. Common in mines and common in hydroelectric tunnels, you know, where they used to seal the access tunnels there for the workings. You've got overall kind of three general designs. You've got kind of thinner slabs kind of keyed into walls. You know, those are good for some low-pressure situations. I have these tapered plugs. That's always a nice one. Those are for real high-pressure situations. Or the simplest ones to build, kind of a parallel plug, essentially just a long plug full of concrete in there. And so what these are kind of mass placements of concrete, typically anywhere from, say, some of the little cheesy ones might be, 3 to 5 feet long. Generally, you're looking at ones that are, 8, 12, 25, 30, feet long. So they're pretty big structures, and they do take up the whole mine workings there. And they hold back the water. Let's take a look at in a little bit more detail. This would be more of a detailed design drawing on here. Won't spend much time on that. You do have your concrete plug, but what you do before you concrete that in, well, you put in some rock bolts up there, to make sure the ground's nice and solid. You drill grout holes in place to, seal the surrounding fractures in the rock. And then you place your concrete, and you have a nice stainless steel bypass pipe and a sampling pipe in there to let you, take samples and control the water in there. Then once you've placed that concrete in, see the little contact grout sleeves there on the sides. You drill back through, and you really seal that contact between the actual mine rock and the concrete right there. So nicely sealed. Here's the view in the two sections. You've got your big grout ring right there in the middle, where you're treating the whole ground in the area. And then you've got those contact grout sleeves where you're really treating that interface between your concrete plug and the surrounding rock. All right, so that's what a bulkhead is. Let's take a look at what a bulkhead isn't. This right here is a collapsed portal, not a bulkhead. This is a collapsed tunnel, again, not a bulkhead. People love to talk about, oh, this bulkhead blew out and this bulkhead blew out. Well, no, that was not a bulkhead. That was a pile of rock and dirt and schmutz inside a mine that blew out after the water built up too high behind it. This is a bulkhead. Here we are. Okay. Now we've got a lovely sampling port. We've got a big old bypass pipe with a really nice valve on it, a nice good mass-placed concrete. Here's the bulkhead, too, and this is a bulkhead that's been in operation for a while, so you've got the dripping right here, you know, on the backside, on the front side of it. So those are the actual bulkheads. Let's chat a little bit about bulkhead placement. Well, they're going to be deep in the mine, because you need to build them under enough cover that the rock is, you know, strong enough and solid enough that they can hold back the water. It needs to be in good ground. If the ground's all fractured, well, you could have a great concrete plug, and all the water's just going to dribble through all the fractures around it, and it's not going to do anything. In pairs, often they're installed in pairs, so you're kind of stepping down the pressure as you're making your way out. So that could be something that's done. And, you know, when you place bulkheads, you start at the very lowest level of your mine, and then you start working your way up. So you start with a drainage tunnel, and you work your way through all the other connected mines, you know, until you've sealed up the mountain to the elevation that you want to go with. And so that includes all other mines in the area that are semi-connected. You know, they may be connected through actual workings, you know, like these like other shafts and things. Or they may just be connected through veins, you know, because they're on the same geologic structures. Or they're connected through drill holes. They may have been drilled between sites. So, you know, you have to understand the hydrogeology and the whole extent of the area that you're going to impact. Because, you know, you may decide, boy, I should have to seal the water in. But if you find out, boy, I'm going to have to build 100 bulkheads to seal all these openings, yeah, that's probably not going to work. You know, if you've got a nice solid mountain with only a couple openings, yeah, bulkheads may be a good idea. Another key point is, once you've committed to starting a bulkheading program, you can't stop halfway. You know, either keep the mountain drained or you seal it up. If you seal up the bottom part and then have water pouring out at the upper levels, then you have the worst of both worlds, and life is not good. Okay, so this right here, one of the things that are most interesting in working like with my bulkheads and that are the various bulkhead myths and things that are out there. You know what people may think about them. And while I go through some of these, if you guys maybe send over to Gene any myths that you may have heard about bulkheads at the end of the talk, I'd love to be able to address some of those. Those are really always, you know, kind of pretty entertaining and stuff. So if you have any to share, that'd be great. Anyway, some myths that I've run across with right here. So bulkheads are the right solution for every mine site. No. If the ground's really permeable or there are way too many openings, not a good choice. Bulkheads will eliminate all mine water drainage. No, they'll probably knock it down by a lot, by, you know, 90%. You know, you've got 1,000 gallons a minute coming out. You can probably knock that down to about 100, you know, so... And that's great because, hey, you know, if you've got 1,000 gallons coming out, you're probably looking at a, you know, lime treatment plant. 100 gallons, you've got some passive treatment options, which can be a lot cheaper in the long run. The next myth is the favorite of, a lot of people that put it on bulkheads or, you know, anybody that's thinking of it. Bulkheads can be installed and forgotten. They're maintenance free. No. They do need regular inspection monitoring. So, you know, you need to keep access to them. You need to check them, make sure they're doing what they're supposed to do. You need to check the surrounding area to make sure they're not affecting anything bad. So there's still some work involved. Now, is it anywhere near as expensive as a treatment plant? Absolutely not, but there's still some work. All right, next myth. Bulkheads only affect individual mines. All bulkhead are my workings, and don't worry about yours. It's not a different mine. Well, it does affect other mines because... you raise the groundwater up enough, you'll flood other workings. And so it's really important that bulkheads are part of a holistic solution for the whole site. You know, if you've got different operators in there, they have to come to some sort of agreement. Or a lot of times it's very handy when they are actually part of a Superfund site because, you know, then EPA can say, okay, this is what we're doing, you know, for this whole region, this whole hill or whatever. And finally, bulkheads always improve water quality. Typically, yes. I mean, that's part of the deal with bulkheads. You know, if you reduce the amount of oxygen available for your pyrolytic reaction, you know, it tends to improve that. But you do, you know, mobilize different metal salts that are there in the mine, and that can be a problem. In particular, if you're just using your bulkheads for temporary storage, you can get some periods of bad water in there. All right, bulkhead risks, real and imagined. Let's go with the imagined ones first, because they're really a lot more fun. You know, the idea is that if you put a bulkhead in and stop the mountain, at some point all the water is going to squirt right out of the top of the mountain. Kind of fun, but yeah, not really. The water is going to go back to kind of whatever natural level it has had in there. Or how about this one? The bulkhead concrete blows out explosively and shoots out of the adder like a cannonball. That'd be a really terrifying way for it to fail, but again, not a real risk. What are the real risks here now? Well, you know, there's a bunch of leakage past the bulkhead, and you need to grout up the area in front of it, or perhaps you install a second bulkhead. Sure. Water flows out of other mine workings, known and unknown. You know, you think you've sealed all the workings, you feel really good about yourself, and after monitoring there for a while, you realize there's a bunch of orange stuff coming out underneath that pile of rocks, under that grove of trees. Uh-oh, well, another thing to seal. You get more seeps developed in the surrounding area. You expect some. Are they a problem? See. Another thing is that real risk, you know, there is going to be some water seeping past the bulkhead. Might this still require treatment? It might. Hopefully just passive. But, you know, something else you need to be ready for. Another real risk, especially when you're talking about high-pressure bulkheads, is really a piping failure on the bulkhead. And that's where if you've got some kind of a crack or joint that's connected to the mine pool and water's just dripping through it and it takes out, you know, some of the fines, which then kind of opens up the hole, and then more water flows through and picks up more fines, and then more water flows through and picks up more fines, all of a sudden you have a piping failure, and you end up opening up the whole ground and blowing it out like that. And, of course, final risk, liability for flooding adjacent mines. Okay, so how do you integrate a bulkhead into the site plan? Well, so a bulkhead is typically just going to be one part of a site solution. You know, because, again, it's not this install it and go home and never think of it again. So you do it, you know, with a whole site-wide monitoring sampling program. So you'll probably have flumes and stream gauges to see how the streams are being affected. There may be some settlement ponds of some sort. You might have passive treatment for stuff coming out. You might be dealing with some in-situ treatment inside the mine pool. You may still have to have a treatment plant of some sort. So part of the plan. Now, bulkheads can be used in various ways. You can use it as a flow control structure. Now, that's something where you're not really using the water for long-term storage. Essentially, you're letting all the water through, but you manage kind of burps in the mine pool. You know, a lot of times if you have a treatment plant, you know, the treatment plant may work really great, you know, at say 500 GPM. But if you get one of these burps where you have a roof fall and the big surge of water comes out, all of a sudden you've got 2,000 GPM flowing out for a couple of days, the treatment plant can't handle that. Well, the flow control structure, you just, you know, adjust your valve so that you're running 500 GPM and your treatment plant works and life's good. These do require cleaning and maintenance for all the pipelines, the valves, your sensors. You can use them for temporary storage. You know, maybe your mountain is really porous, and as soon as you really pressure that thing up, it's sort of leaking all over, and it's a problem. So what you might use, you might store the water in there temporarily while you deal with surface water on the outside, and then drain the water back down over the course of the treatment cycle. You may just also keep the water in there long enough for some in-situ treatment that you're doing to do its thing, and then are able to release it in better shape. Or perhaps it's going to be a permanent seal where you really return the groundwater to pre-mining conditions, sort of, and you know, then just treat you know, seeps with passive means, you know, seeps past the bulkhead, seeps in other areas. You still need to monitor the bulkhead regularly, you know, the actual face, the pressure behind it, you know what that is, and you might still end up doing some kind of in-situ treatment. So as we get towards the end of the talk here, talk a little bit about the post-bulkhead installation. So you've got that bulkhead in place. You know, you need to keep that access in there, you know, to look for any seepage past it and be able to check the water levels behind it. You know, it was designed for a certain pressure. You need to make sure that that it's within that operating pressure. You also need to develop and execute a real filling and monitoring plan for these ball on these bulkheads. You know, figure out the flow rates in there. Figure out, you know, how quickly you want to pressure these things up, and then, you know, you check the water chemistry before and after. You check the flows of other bulkheads and other adits. You check what's happening in surrounding mines and seeps and nearby streams. And of course, you have to actually inspect the bulkhead itself. You take a look at the concrete. Is it deteriorating? Is it still okay? What's the condition of the pipes and valves? What's the condition of the instruments behind there? Are there any concentrated flows coming around the bulkhead? Are there concentrated flows coming downstream of the bulkhead? Is something about to wash out? You know, do we need to come in and do some additional work? And of course, you know, is it still safe to access that area, or do you need to install some more ground support to get in there? So, a couple concluding thoughts here for you. So bulkheads may or not be the right solution for your site. They certainly should only be installed after real significant study and design. So, you know, if you've just inherited some mine site and it's draining water, someone tells you, boy, you should just plug this up and, you know, let's do it on Thursday. You probably want to figure out if that's a good idea first. Keep in mind that adjacent mines may be affected. You got to find them first, figure out if they're going to be a problem or not. And, of course, that monitoring maintenance is needed after installation. So this right here is kind of some highlights of kind of what the Cliff Notes version of what you need to know about bulkheads on a site. Here's another shameless plug for another Cluin seminar here in about 2 weeks. They'll be doing together with Dr. Joy Jenkins from EPA and with Jeff Graves with the Colorado Division of Reclamation, Mining, and Safety. We're going to do a whole 2-hour seminar just on bulkheads. We'll address design a little bit more, and the water treatment and several case studies. So that's going to be coming up on October 25th, and got the link for it right there. I'm sure Gene will share that with everybody too. And with that, let's end up with a really nice and pleasing slide brought to you by the Colorado Tourism Board of a nicely, relatively clean mine site. So thanks, everyone.
Well, thanks, Christoph. That was pretty interesting. We do have a number of questions. I'll try to get to a few of them right now, and if we have time at the end, we'll answer a few more. So the question came up, you talked about inspection of bulkheads. There are probably situations where those bulkheads aren't accessible because they're in the lower or deeper reaches of the mine or might not have people access at some point. How do you go about inspecting some of these inaccessible bulkheads? Or do you?
Sure. Well, and in some cases you can. So you really should be inspecting these bulkheads because you don't really know what's going on. And, you know, when you can't see them, you know, then it is a bit of a problem. You know, ideally, what you do is you've got some deeper in and then maybe another bulkhead or two closer to the end and, you know, so you're able to inspect that last one. In some cases, you are able to still access them with some additional work. We recently did that on a site where, you know, we did open up the portal area, secured the ground for about the first 300 feet. We got to the face last bulkhead. We're able to inspect that bulkhead, and then actually drilled a piezometer in behind the bulkhead, you know, from the side of the hill, to be able to check the water level in there behind it. So in that way, we're able to find more about it. But yes, in some cases, you can't inspect them, and then it's kind of a problem because when the question comes up, is the bulkhead fine? The answer is, I don't know. Hope so.
All right, thanks. And, you know, one of the questions that did come up also, you had mentioned that sometimes bulkheading can cause release in other areas or unexpected areas, these seeps or other springs. How would you address that in terms of either identifying those springs or addressing the releases?
Sure. And, you know, that's going to real depend. You do expect, seeps to, you expect the water to seep out in some spots. So the big thing is, you know, look for any seeps ahead of time, you know, be able to document what's happening, see if there are any changes. You know, a lot of that's really going to kind of depend on kind of what your requirements are for water in the area. You know, if you have a little seep coming out the side of a mountain of a few GPM, it may not have any effect. If a seep gets bad, then you may need to You know, perhaps install like maybe kind of a more of a drain control dam or something in there. You know, in some cases, maybe you lead water from the seep into like a series of settlement ponds. They have some passive treatment or not. So it really depends on what the water quality is and how much is coming out. The bigger problem tends to be if you have any of these, you know, some collapsed adit of some sort that nobody knew about. You know, perhaps there was an opening into the mine workings that's been covered by landslide debris, and no one knows where it is, and all of a sudden it's filled with water and then comes flowing right out. And that's where you have a bigger problem. That's when, you know, it's great if you have access to your bulkhead to where you can actually release water until the water stops flowing out of that unknown adit. You can get in there, you can open that up, you can install another, you know, another bulkhead or flow control structure in that place, and then move on with your day.
All right. Well, thank you. There are a couple more questions. If we have time at the end, we'll circle back and try to get you to answer some additional questions. Thanks. So our final speaker, as I mentioned, is Terry Burton. And he's going to talk about managing legacy uranium mines on tribal sites. Terry, are you online?
I am online, Jim. Can you hear me?
Sounds great, Terry. Let's get started.
All right. As you can see, my sites are not quite as bucolic as Christoph's Colorado sites, but we're going to primarily just dive right on into uranium mines. And legacy mining activities have really affected the health and environment of numerous Native American communities, and I want to specifically focus on the ones in the American Southwest. I really want to emphasize that quantifying those impacts is well beyond the scope of this presentation. There's a lot of excellent research going on there that I'm just not going to have time to address. However, I will want to briefly touch on aspects of tribal life that will need to be considered during these types of responses, and so we'll get to that in a few minutes. This particular site is the Section 25 residential site. For those of our folks who are not doing mine stuff in the American Southwest, we typically talk in sections. A section is basically a 1 square mile area. Our sites are so large that talking about acres tends to get things lost, and so sections is usually what we'll discuss. This particular residence is about 10 miles north of Milan, New Mexico. That area is primarily famous for a privately run federal prison, so that's kind of the landmark for the area. Primary residence we're going to discuss is a 180-acre parcel of land. I want to be up front in exchange for being able to use this data. I was asked to show some sensitivity toward the particulars of the site, so I'll be a little less than forthcoming about the exact residence. Let's discuss the residential site geology right quick. You don't need to be a geologist to figure out lots of sandstone type rocks. Those of you who are sharp-eyed geologists will be able to see that's a limestone outcropping. This happens to be about 100 meters away from the structure. This is interesting because this is the Todilto limestone, and it's extremely rare that a limestone formation would contain uranium. Limestone's got relatively low permeability, porosity, and few organic co-precipitants. That usually makes it inhospitable for uranium in the matrix, and so your mining engineers are going to be particularly interested and well-versed in this particular area. Dozens of uranium-producing mines have been established in this particular formation. I want to highlight that the home is located in an area literally termed Poison Canyon. Those of you who are emergency responders, if you get cues like that, that should be a hint and a half about what you're about to get into. For this particular site, there are 5 abandoned uranium mines located within a quarter mile of the residence. Just to give you a little bit of reference as to the scale of mining in the area, between this section, section 25, and section 30, so that's 2 square miles, there are probably about 100 uranium deposits that have produced ore from both open pit and underground mining. So a very, very lucrative area for uranium mining. Typically, living close to a mine results in concerns about polluted groundwater, high concentrations of heavy metals in soil, low pH runoff, and extreme difficulty revegetating the land. I want you to hang on to this. I'll circle back to it in a minute. Simply, though, when we're dealing with emergency response, we're talking about stuff that can be accomplished in 12 months or less, and we simply cannot address those types of impacts in the 12-month time period. Usually what we're focusing on are quicker actions and things that are more likely to be of more immediate effect to human health. Radon in particular seems to be a big issue in all manner of uranium-bearing areas. The U.S. Geological Survey has found radon up to 100,000 picocuries per liter. The EPA action level for indoor areas is 4. So we really need to make sure we do proper characterization when we respond to these sites, particularly when we respond in sort of an emergency fashion. We have to triage our activities to make sure that we're getting what we need to get. Just as a quick aside, some of you may be working on units of working levels, so 4 picocuries per liter is about 0.02 working level. I think we're trying to phase out that. So the EPA Region 6 office has been performing assessments to determine impacts from these activities. We have added several former uranium mines in the upper New Mexico area. As you can see from this example, we're using gamma scans to be able to figure out where our hotspots are, and obviously the hot colors tend to line up well with the former mines. A little caution, this particular gamma scan is from a different area than the Section 25 residents, but the Section 25 residents would show similar results. So we are using this gamma spectroscopy as a characterization tool to sort of figure out where we need to really focus our efforts. So the gamma spectrometer basically analyzes the gamma ray spectrum at a location. Typical unit has 4 parts that work together. I didn't want to give you a picture because I didn't want to seem like I was endorsing one system over another, but every unit pretty much has your translating software that ties everything together and gives you your results, the electronics that route the impulses where they need to go, a cooling mechanism, and obviously a detector. For those of you who are old salts like me, you might remember that these units used to require an entire room in a laboratory, and they're now field deployed. They used to require weeks of hold time and analyses. The 30-day hold time was the standard at one time. Now results are near instantaneous. You no longer need a PhD to operate these things, just a skilled operator. It's a big boon that they can do large areas quickly and with relatively good accuracy. We primarily use them for radon gas, but they can be used for detecting radon in water as well. At the Section 25 residential site, we did a 7-day radon test, and this was part of a larger study for the San Mateo Creek watershed. And I'll get back to that briefly in a couple minutes. The results at this particular site came out at about 16.5 picocuries per liter. You may remember the level of 4 picocuries per liter, so that's more than 4 times that number. The homeowners declined to have a cleanup conducted. Our regional health physicist here has established that if we do 2 tests 6 years apart and both are over 4 times the acceptable level, then that's a rationale for emergency action. And so emergency action would basically allow us to waive a 90-day test and immediately start installation of a mitigation system. So the 90-day test, for those of you who are familiar, you're talking about your alpha track or your electrode ion chamber test. Another 7-day test was conducted again in 2016, yielded similar results to 2010. I want to emphasize that the resident has 2 full-time adult residents, but also small grandchildren that visit on a routine basis. A year later, the homeowners contacted EPA and requested a mitigation system and resumption of our investigations here. So the residence is a good-sized residence. It's 4,200 square feet, 2 levels. One of the challenges is not just the size of the house, but also that it has a walkout basement. And this sort of hampered installation of the remedial equipment. For all systems of radon mitigation, and there are various ones commercially available, you're looking at 2 parts primarily. One, a method to prevent influx of new radon. And then the other one is simply to get the radon that's in there out of the system. So total costs, about $48,000 for this particular residence. Initial reports are that the system is successfully remediating the radon concentrations at the particular residence we're discussing. So I want to extrapolate out from that a little bit and discuss what would be some of the reasons why someone would delay or refuse remedial action at a property. And I'm going to be painfully clear that I'm not necessarily pointing to this particular residence, but this is sort of an extrapolation of multiple data points. There's historical distrust of the American government among many Native American peoples. There's a historical distrust of outsiders in general among Native Americans. And then a huge one for these communities is a fear of disruption or even termination of their tribal lifestyles. Amanda Hoff and Dr. Diane Barton really put out an excellent presentation where they flipped this around because tribal lifestyles could be considered voluntary, and want to really think of these as tribal lifeways. And this is an umbrella where you have disposal, resources, food, culture, ceremonies, and human health. And as responders, we may be faced with situations where spiritual health of the people who are on site might be a more pressing concern than physical health at any one point in time. And so we need to be prepared for that discussion. One of the real take-home points I'm hoping to get across is that every rock, every plant, every animal in this tribal environment is potentially a food, medicine, or cultural resource on these lands. So losing these valuable resources, even temporarily, can really stress people out, and they may flatly decide not to follow what you consider to be sound advice. And so want you to consider there are multiple pathways for exposure that normal risk assessors may not fully consider. You're using water not only for drinking and bathing, but potentially for ceremonial uses as well. Larger number of activities that incorporate the land and land resources, on-site food preparation and production. And so these are all things that your risk assessors really should be considering in the back of their heads. Because of that, standard risk assessment techniques might be inadequate. I would really encourage responders to be as informed as possible about the activities on these land. I really want to encourage you to talk to the people there and get an idea of what's really going on. At the same time, though, we will also need to make sure that we're respectful of tribal sovereignty. If the tribal peoples choose to keep some of their activities confidential, clearly we have to respect that, and there are times where you may just need a best guess. So on a lot of these lands, hundreds of abandoned mines, problem cannot be easily minimized. One-size-fits-all approach might not be the right approach and could even lead you down the wrong path. I want you to remember that there were 5 abandoned uranium mines within a short distance of Residence 25. Gives you lots of potential for exposure. On the other side of that exposure is the overwhelming size of many of these mines that we have in the western part of the U.S. So we're talking about mines that are literally the size of entire counties in other states. I mentioned earlier to you the San Mateo Creek site. We're actually considering that for addition to the national priorities list next year. This particular site is going to be over 200 square miles. So if you can imagine cleaning up an area the size of Dublin, Ireland, plus Paris, France, plus Brussels, Belgium, and then you're only half done. So given all this, these are challenges that are going to require innovative and multidisciplinary solutions. I'm going to remind you again, 200 square miles of polluted water, polluted groundwater, high concentration of heavy metals, low pH runoff from storm flooding, and extreme difficulty revegetating. It's clear we can't just recycle our old ways of thinking and reach a finish line on sites of these size. So just a rhetorical question, what can you bring to the table to help with these challenges? So to sum, I am indebted to the efforts of Warren Zaner, Bill Rotenberry, and John Reinhart. They're our on-scene coordinators who put their boots on the ground and got this work done. Amanda Hoff and Dr. Diane Barton as well. And then our standard EPA disclaimer. Any questions?
Terry, this is Jim again. I think we're still waiting for a few questions, but I had a couple. You know, you mentioned a number of tribal lifeways that should be considered in response actions. In your response to the Section 25 residential mitigation, did you encounter any specific issues that you could elaborate on?
Well, and again, I don't want to go specifically with this particular residence, but take it a little more broadly. Many of the Native peoples have long memories about the federal government saying one thing and not necessarily providing what they were purporting to do. So that cultural distrust is really strong, and that can really be difficult to overcome. So our standard, here we are, we're here to save the day, is not necessarily going to be well received. And so I think we have to really make sure that we go in both with respect and with understanding that just getting our foot in the door might be a process. And there's the whole environmental justice umbrella. You're talking about typically communities with not only health issues, but they're often lower income. They're a whole raft of other issues that go along with it that I'm really not going to address. But there are strategies and techniques that we're using that EPA will help provide researchers with, but just going in blind is often a recipe for hurt feelings on both sides.
Sure. So kind of a follow-up to that, have the tribes given you any recommendations on how to improve these response actions or be more responsive to the needs of the tribes?
Yes, but that's not across the board. There are some tribes that are very welcoming and almost eager to provide assistance, and that's why I really wanted to recommend that we simply ask. See what we can find out. I believe there are a couple that have even written up resources that would be helpful. The converse of that is there may be other tribes or pueblos that don't want you to know what happens in this particular area. They don't want you to know that they use this particular plant, and so you'll have to respect that.
Okay. So going back to one of your figures, when you were talking about the gamma spectroscopy, I got a couple of technical questions on that. Was that survey done as a ground-based kind of a grid sampling? I noticed you had a very, very large area of coverage there. How was that done?
Yes, it is definitely a grid sampling type thing. We're primarily using this, as I said, for characterization. We want to be able to figure out where to really sink our money and our time and efforts. And so if you're talking about hundreds of square miles, doing a 7-day test for every area is just going to take forever, and it's going to be prohibitively expensive. Instead, we want to use this particular tool, in this case, gamma spectroscopy, to really hone down and refine the areas where we need to be looking, places that we need to be addressed, residences that we feel are likely going to need extra work to get them to safer human standards. And so when we get actually physically on site, so like on this particular residence, then we'll go like to the 7-day charcoal canister type studies, but this particular technology for wide-scale research is really the way to go, and I definitely recommend it.
So it sounds like it's a collaborative data approach where the gamma spectroscopy would be kind of your screening or initial test, and then you would follow up with something more detailed and more specific like the 7-day charcoal test.
That's absolutely true, and I was discussing that it's even field deployable. We're even getting it to where they're now trying it out on aircraft, and I think the ideal would be in a few years to be able to even have these drone deployed. Now, whether we'll actually be able to use drones or not, I don't know, but that's a different issue. But that's where the technology is going.
And did you do the gamma spectroscopy survey with lines from aerial platform, ATV, or just stay on the roads? Just a little more detail on that survey.
Okay. This particular one, I believe, was done both with lines and with ATVs. The one you're looking at, I don't recall the exact way we did the area for the San Mateo Creek, just because that was a larger area. I'd have to get back with you on that. I'm not sure about that one.
Okay. Well, thanks. So, folks, if you have any additional questions, please feel free to drop them in. We do have a few more minutes for questions. Thank you very much, Terry. That was a great presentation. Fascinating stuff. I'd like to go back. We have a couple of questions that came in. So I'd like to go back to Tom. Tom, if you're still on the line, we had a couple of questions regarding apparently a number of these phosphate facilities, processing facilities, have an issue with radionuclides. Was that an issue down in Mississippi? And if so, how did you address it?
It was not, although it was investigated for that. So we had another ERT member, in fact, go down and do a RAD survey of the facility, and there was low-level radioactivity, mainly whenever you take, you know, materials away from rock, you end up concentrating the naturally occurring radionuclides in it. But it was not deemed a human health threat at that site.
Okay.
But you're right. These gypstack piles can have a radioactive issue associated with them.
Yeah. So there was an awful lot of gypstack material there. And I know that in some cases, this material can be used as a source material for other products. Is there a market for this gypstack solids? Obviously, you have a lot at that facility. Do you know if that's an option here?
You know, there is a lot of research along that line. And so far, at least to my knowledge, there is not a market, not a viable market for the quantity that's out there. Because the radionuclides, that can be an issue. And other aspects, some of those close-up photos of the deteriorating gypstack pile, you could see the sulfur that was crystallizing on the gypstack. There are just a lot of impurities that seem to create problems. But I was on a website just the other day about, you know, beneficial reuse of gypstack. And it's the subject of a lot of research, but I didn't get the impression from the articles I was reading that there are really any viable markets at this point. But a lot of research along that line.
Jim, this is Terry Burton.
Yeah.
About 12 years ago, I was the ORD lead for a project that was trying to reuse gypstacks. We actually were able to figure out a process that combined it with residue from phosphogypsum and a product called red mud from the aluminum processing. Mm-hmm. And it made a geotechnically superior material, and we thought that we were going to be able to market it for all sorts of concrete replacement projects, and it turned out that the radioactivity just shot us down. We couldn't get past that.
Interesting. So there is, it sounds like there's some information available if folks want to dig into that a little deeper. So in the few minutes that we have left, I have a question. I'll direct it to Tom first, but I'd like to hear each of the speakers address the issue. And it has to do with resiliency. Now, we heard four really great talks today about responses, emergency response, and responding to different situations. It sounds like from several of the talks that there's a lot of good planning that's required. How do we best build in resiliency as we look forward to new rods, new decision documents, and addressing some of these sites that are coming up? For example, we have a lot of sites coming up that that will fall under this legacy uranium mining, as well as many of the mining sites that are going to be listed soon. Ken, starting with Tom, Tom, could you give us a word or two on what should we be considering to build in resiliency into our decision documents and other site activities?
Could you define resiliency for me a little bit? I hear the term a lot, but what exactly do you mean, Jim?
So as Lily expressed, there are a lot of natural conditions that can occur. And we want to make sure that whatever we design, whatever we propose as a long-term solution is effective in the long term and is not affected by these extreme weather conditions or other conditions that appear to be much more common now. So does that help?
Yeah, it does. You know, I'd say with Mississippi Phosphates, the biggest thing that we were trying to do, and I don't know that it was the best thing to do in hindsight, but it certainly, it was an option that we wanted to keep on the table, and that was keeping the facility in a condition where we could find a potential buyer who wanted to operate that facility as a diammonium phosphate fertilizer plant. And there were a number of interested buyers. I think, in general, most of them wanted a way to get around acquiring the GIPSTAC complex, but and what they wanted to do was to get Mississippi to allow underground injection so that they wouldn't have to deal with managing process water and wastewater on the surface. So that was the reason that, you know, a lot of money went in trying to maintain these GIPSTACs in a semi-operable mode, because there's just a buyer around the corner and they'll take over the operation. The problem is with that is that it only takes a year or two before these things just start falling apart, you know, and you really don't have anything of value. So then what I think in hindsight was a really smart move that, you know, we did do, and when I say we, this is a lot of people were involved with this project, and not necessarily me, but they were building in these pumping capacities and discharge capacities and water treatment capacities. And the one thing that they went with on this particular site was in-situ treatment. Rather than build a new wastewater treatment plant or upgrade the existing wastewater treatment plant, which would have been a capital improvement, they basically added lime to a pond or a number of the ponds that were at that complex and mixed it with backhoes and, you know, basically let the, use that as pretreatment or complete neutralization treatment of the material rather than running it through a plant. Again, as I said, it's mainly a lime process, and bring the pH up to 11 and it drops everything out of solution. Then you have to aerate it for a while so the ammonia strips off so that you can then neutralize it and discharge it to the bayou. The problem with that was these ponds would end up full of lime sludge, and then you no longer had those ponds as holding capacity. So, you know, the whole thing down there is water management. You have a number of buckets, and then unfortunately what you have is an awful lot of water falling down from the sky, filling up your buckets with fresh water that's contaminated once it hits that. So it was, in the end, I think it was increasing the discharge capacity and treatment capacity so that you could move a lot of water around this facility and then get to the point where we had the funding and the commitment to reduce the footprint. And once the footprint's reduced, now you have a lot more options at hand, but you don't have the option of having an operable GIPSTAC anymore. You've closed it. So I don't know if that answers your questions, but our idea of resiliency was, you know, trying to find a buyer to take over the operation, and the second one was having the flexibility to move water around in the event that Mother Nature turned against you, which it did.
Right, so building in that capacity into your planning.
Yeah.
Sounds good. Well, Lily, you covered a number of specific issues. Can you recap some of these key points for resiliency planning?
Sure, happy to. I guess that I would just say to be a little bit pessimistic, to assume that that the world you're in might shift a little bit if you're looking at the long-term response at a mine site. The conditions change over time. We've seen a higher frequency of floods and large-scale fires And I think that the assumption that something like this might happen once every 10 years, we've had to kind of shift our thinking and accept that every couple of years we have either a really large scale, flood event or a fire of some type, and whether it's really small or it's the scale of the example from the car fire, that these things do happen, and you have to use every single one of these examples to feed into planning for the next one. So I think the biggest lesson is just to assume that the worst case or some of the kind of worst things can happen and that they will, and to just take that as an opportunity to create more redundancies in your system, which, as I mentioned, you know, come at a cost. It's by definition an inefficiency, but those inefficiencies end up being your lifeline. And I didn't have a lot of time to get into it, but one thing about the remedy at Iron Mountain Mine is there is a ton of redundancy built in, and there are components of the site that have almost completely mirrored systems in the event that there is a failure in just one piece of one of those systems. So I think building in redundancy and assuming that severe emergencies will happen is a great place to start.
Thanks, Lily. Christoph, so in considering the bulkhead design for long-term management of mine-influenced water, are there things that we should consider related to long-term resiliency in these bulkhead designs?
Sure. I mean, the bulkhead design is, long-term. You know, you assume that once you've got the water sealed in the mountain, that you're never ever going to drain it again. You know, you've just, you know, this is what it's going to be. You over-design the things to, you know, give them a very long service life. Do your inspections, do some additional adjustments, as needed. And, you just design them for really the maximum really possible head that you could really expect to see, whether that's in 1 year or 5 years or 100 years. I guess in regards to resiliency, the only thing you could add is if there's some specific areas, that are that really seem to be influence the mine pool, where there's a lot of water that comes in, there may be some runoff controls that you'd be able to put in those areas, do some regrading to keep less water on there. But overall, underground, you're pretty resilient.
Yeah, definitely. All right, and finally, Terry, can you think of any resiliency considerations for designing response actions related to legacy uranium sites?
Well, that's one of the reasons I really wanted to bring in the tribal aspects, because that's really going to be a primary determinant for making sure that we do have not only the resiliency, but also the ability to respect what is going on there and yet still keep an eye on what could potentially happen in the future. And so when you multiply that, though, with large-scale sites, it's definitely going to be challenging to do.
All right. Well, thank you. I know we're right at our 3 o'clock time limit here, so I'd like to turn it back over to Gene. Thank you very much to all the speakers for your great work and addressing these comments.
All right. Thank you so very much, Jim. I'm going to walk through very quickly a few final reminders before we officially close out today's session. As noted, this is a multi-part series. We already completed session one last week. We've just done session two. And we'll carry on with the series next Wednesday on October 16th, where we work on session three. The focus will be innovative technologies and strategies. So I hope that you'll be able to join us for the following sessions in the series. Remember, all of the sessions will be recorded and archived. And in fact, you can already find a URL for session number one, the first session in the series, on the middle right under related URLs. If you'd like to learn about related webinars, I know that Christoph mentioned another one that we're hosting later this month. I strongly encourage you to visit us at CLUIN or sign up for our free monthly newsletter, Tech Direct, which goes out on the first of each month. Those of you looking for copies of the presentation materials, you'll find those on the resources page or links. You saw that page when you checked in today. There's a tab there for presentation or resources. You can click that and actually download each of the talks. You'll also find that information on the middle right of your screen. If you're looking for contact information for any of our presenters or organizers, you'll also find that on the speakers list. Again, you'll find that off of the seminar homepage. And I will ask each of you to fill out the online feedback form to let us know what you thought of today's delivery. A few points about that online feedback form. If you're looking for a participation certificate, you'll get one if you complete the online feedback form. Just make sure you check the box at the very bottom certifying you were there for the whole session or you replayed the entire archive. And then as long as the email address on that form is entered correctly, as soon as you submit your feedback form, you'll immediately get access to a certificate that you can either print or save for your own record. Share the line with multiple people at your location. Each person can fill out that feedback form, even if they didn't register for the session individually. So if you are in a conference room together, please be sure to get the link to that feedback form. Again, you'll find it on the right side of the screen, and then to share that with the individuals who joined you from your particular room. I do get questions about CEUs or PDHs. While we don't offer those particular things, if you're looking to earn credit for CLPs, that's a different type of credit hour, we've included information that you can actually copy and paste into the CLP form. Most of the details you would need when requesting CLPs is already available on the seminar homepage, but you can request up to 1.5 hours for this particular session through your CLP request. All right, and so with that, I'll remind everybody that our session was recorded. You will automatically get an email as soon as the archive is available. It should be ready in approximately 1 week. And again, I hope that we'll find you all with us next week when we carry on with the series with session number 3. I want to thank all of you who took time out of your busy day to join us. We had many participants from across the U.S. today, as well as all of the speakers and organizers who took time out of their schedules to share their expertise and time with us. This will be the formal conclusion for today's live broadcast.